This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with lawyer and author Dean Strang about his new book, Keep the Wretches in Order.
The subtitle of the book is America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department, and the Fall of the IWW. This trial teaches us a lot of lessons for today. Stay tuned.
After 4 decades in prison, Janine and Janet Africa are now free.
They're part of the Move 9. This is a hidden history, a story that's so awful, every American should know what happened to them.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Before World War I, the government reaction to labor dissent had been local, ad hoc, and quasi-military. Sheriffs, mayors, or governors would elevate strikebreakers to deputies or call out the state militia, usually at the bidding of employers. At the time, one of the nation's largest unions was the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the Wobblies. The IWW had members in critical industries across the country. In April of 1917, when the United States entered the war, the government feared the threat of a labor strike from such a large number of workers that would put in danger or even hold up war production. Officials in the relatively young Department of Justice determined that a more coordinated strategy would be necessary. To prevent stoppages, the DOJ embarked on a sweeping new effort, replacing gunmen with lawyers. The department systematically targeted the IWW, resulting in the largest mass trial in U.S. history. The first of 4 indictments named 166 defendants in September of 1917. The Chicago trial started with 112 men accused sitting on bleachers with one small defense team and a judge and prosecutors who did not know their names or faces. In the first legal history of this landmark federal trial, our guest attorney Dean A. Strang, author of the new book, Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department, and the Fall of the IWW, talks about how the case laid the groundwork for a fundamental different strategy to stifle radical threats and played a major role in the shaping of the modern Justice Department. As the case unfolded, it became an exercise in raw force, raising serious questions about its legitimacy and revealing the fragility of a criminal justice system under pressure from banks and industrialists who supported the war. Dean A. Strang practices law in Madison, Wisconsin.
Dean Strang, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
First, congratulations on your wonderful new book, Keep the Wretches in Order. We wanted to ask you to talk about the IWW at the beginning of World War I. Where did it come from? What did it stand for? And how strong was it?
The IWW was a really innovative union that had been founded in 1905 in Chicago, actually, by a collection of members and leaders of the Western Federation of Miners and socialists and some anarchists and generally people toward the left end of the American political spectrum at the time and from the labor movement. And the great innovation of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, was its reaction to the way in which it understood the labor movement, I think correctly at the time, which was, look, as we look out across the labor movement, what we see are workers organized by skills or narrow craft groups, trade groups. And what that means, at least for, you know, for the people who founded the IWW, was that workers were fighting with each other over the same nickel from the employer. And the innovation was to say, let's stop pitting workers against each other that way and start organizing them by vast industry, or what we might think of as industrial sectors today. So if you are involved in, you're a worker involved in shipping, whether you're a longshoreman, some other dock worker, a sailor, you know, on a merchant ship, whatever your role is, you belong in the same industry. If you're a miner, doesn't matter where you are or what your job in relationship to the mine is, you belong in the same union. And that meant also that men and women would be welcome, shoulder to shoulder in the union, people of all races, all ethnicities. A worker was a worker was a worker. In other words, all workers had everything in common and they had nothing in common, to quote the IWW Constitution's preamble, with any employer. So that was sort of the stark but innovative idea. The union's membership ebbed and flowed in the years after 1905, but there's no question that the outbreak of war in Europe in 1914 began to boost IWW membership in North America. And indeed, by 1917, when the United States joined what we now think of as World War I, membership had crested in the IWW. It was probably 70,000 or perhaps more. And it had enormous strength in most of the industries that were essential to wartime production.
Now, at that time, how did the federal government view the IWW?
Very skeptically. This was understood to be the most radical, large union. It stood well apart from Samuel Gompers's American Federation of Labor, which was a much more conventional collection of unions, both in their organization around crafts and trades and in their orientation toward the government and capital, for that matter. The IWW was seen, identified early on by state, local, and federal governments as being a potential threat to the war effort because so many IWW members opposed the war. Many of them opposed it vocally. And the IWW itself was more inclined to strike when pay or working conditions were unsatisfactory than were AFL unions, which I think the leadership of which often integrated sort of a patriotism or a sense of supporting the nation in its war effort at a time of need into the calculus on whether to engage in a work stoppage.
We're speaking with attorney Dean Strang, whose new book, Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department, and the Fall of the IWW, has just come out, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Dean, the government set out to destroy the IWW, the one big union. What social forces were behind the destruction of the IWW? Who profited by it?
The government did exactly that, Michael, really beginning in the summer of 1917 as we're joining the war effort. And the impetus for that came largely from Western industrial interests and then from Western politicians who were beholden to, you know, moneyed mining or lumber or agricultural interests in the West. So the pressure on the federal government really arose from the western United States, west of the Mississippi, essentially, and was exerted not just by employers' associations, although certainly, you know, industrialists themselves or large employers made efforts to persuade the Wilson administration, but much of the pressure also came indirectly from state legislatures, governors, U.S. senators, members of Congress from Western states, responding to the concerns that employers were bringing to them about the threat that the IWW presented to the war effort. And, you know, look, as we're trying to manufacture munitions and ships and these newfangled airplanes and uniforms for soldiers, food for soldiers, all the things you need to wage a war. As we're doing that rapidly in the summer of 1917, this is very profitable for employers. These are good government contracts. They've got essentially, you know, bonuses for rapid delivery. The purse is open from the federal government for employers who could provide essential war material. And so the employers had a profit motive, quite obviously, at stake if the IWW were to freeze or shut down large parts of some of these essential industries. And, I do want to underscore, Michael, that at 70,000 or more strong, the IWW had specific strength in the very industries that were most essential to war production. So logging in the Pacific Northwest, essential for, you know, ship building, airplanes, that kind of thing. Agriculture in the West and Midwest, essential to feeding troops. Cotton growing in the South, uniforms, that kind of thing. Textile production in the Northeast, a real area of IWW strength. And then the vast shipping yards of the Eastern Seaboard were strong IWW territory. The Mesabi Iron Range, where the nation's ore heavily came from, came from an area of IWW strength. And then all of Western mining, lead, copper, the things you need to make ammunition. So there was, you know, to be fair, an accurate perception that the IWW could have frozen up production of some of these wartime items had it called a general strike or just engaged in more local work stoppages.
You know, it was shocking for me to learn from your book, Dean, how previously private attorneys were recruited by the government to the prosecution team. When they were in private practice, what did these attorneys do? And when did they become prosecutors?
Oh, this practice of taking private lawyers, making them special assistant U.S. attorneys, you know, special prosecutors under the aegis of the Justice Department, or before that, just of the United States District Attorney's offices, was widely used, Michael, up into the 1920s. And invariably, these special prosecutors, these, you know, private lawyers pulled in, paid by the U.S. government, and then given the powers of the sovereign to prosecute criminally and potentially imprison. They were all corporate lawyers. They were all lawyers who worked for large employers or employers' associations and were nominated by these employers' associations to serve as special prosecutors. In fact, very often in the 19th century, the employers or employer associations themselves actually paid the salaries or the remuneration to these private lawyers for that public function as a special prosecutor to spare the government that expense. This also happened at the state level in state prosecutions, but I explore it a bit here in the context of federal prosecution. It wasn't until 1870 that the Justice Department was even created. The Attorney General before 1870 was a cabinet official with no department, no agency under him. And once the Justice Department is created in 1870, it's pretty lightly staffed. And the what we call today United States attorneys, and were then United States district attorneys, were patronage appointees. These were sleepy posts. Federal criminal prosecution was a tiny fraction of the overall criminal justice picture in America at that time, still a small fraction even today. So you didn't have the internal capacity in the Justice Department, and they would look outside, and they would look to the employers whose interests were most at stake to provide lawyers they liked and who served their interests.
Dean, the IWW was prosecuted under the 1917 Espionage Act. What does the Espionage Act punish specifically?
It remains today. It was new, of course, back then. It just took effect in the middle of June 1917, just about 102 years ago now. Much of it still is enforced today. In fact, some of its provisions have been expanded and updated for modern times. Some of them have been repealed. The ones that have been repealed are the ones that really would not withstand First Amendment scrutiny today, as courts now understand the freedom of speech. But what remains of the Espionage Act and what was original to it also was, you know, what you could think of as actual espionage. That is, taking government documents that contained war plans or secrets, handing them over, transferring them to a foreign government for the purpose of harming the interests of the United States or assisting a hostile foreign power. I mean, you know, the language is a little more complicated than that, but part of what it covered looked like what we would ordinarily think of as espionage. However, at the time, as originally enacted and is used in this mass trial, the act also forbid any words, statements, public efforts that would encourage insubordination, disloyalty, or interfere with recruitment of troops and retention of troops. And the act also then and now punished and still today punishes conspiracies to do any of those forbidden acts.
Well, that's the key, I think. Conspiracies, a thought crime, darling of the prosecutors, because you don't have to prove a crime. You just have to prove that you thought about it and talked about it with other people. Wasn't that a problem?
And the federal government used that to full effect in this 1918 trial. The indictment was nothing but five conspiracies. 166 people, 165 men and one woman, alleged to have conspired together to, you know, foment insubordination, disloyalty, or lack of, you know, wartime production to the detriment of the interests of the United States. It was a very vague group of conspiracy charges, not one substantive offense alleged against anyone.
Dean, I understand the trials took place in Sacramento, Wichita, and Omaha, in addition to Chicago. How many persons ended up doing time in prison?
Well, Heidi, you're right. There were four indictments. The largest group and the group most heavily tilted toward IWW leadership was in Chicago. That was the first case to go to trial. 97 men ultimately convicted, and all but three or four or five of them went to prison. The subsequent trials on very similar indictments, nearly identical indictments, Sacramento sent 60-some people to prison in the end. Wichita, a smaller number, I want to say 35 or something like that. And Omaha eventually was dropped. They didn't get to try in the Omaha case until well after the war had ended and the appetite for it no longer was there. So in the end, between those prosecutions and then other smaller prosecutions of IWW people, some in federal court, many in state court, I think it's fair to say that well over 300 Wobblies went to prison for anti-war activities during and after our involvement in World War I.
The Chicago trial took 4.5 months, but the jury was out for less than an hour. My understanding of why it was less than an hour was that they scared the pants off the jury. It was a question of fear. What kind of evidence was used against these Wobblies?
Their words. Much of the government's case involved reading letters copies of which had been seized from, you know, the dozens of IWW local offices that were raided on September 5, 1917, and then the months after that. Testimony by undercover sheriff's deputies or Burns detective operatives, detective agency operatives, who were in crowds listening to IWW speakers. Testimony relating some of the inflammatory things that the speaker allegedly said. So it really was just words of opposition to the war. The government had no direct evidence of actual efforts to obstruct the draft, you know, conscription, for example. There were no strikes or work stoppages to which the government could point as any, you know, substantive act intended to impede the war effort. Originally, the government had this wild theory that the Kaiser was funneling German gold to fund the IWW in America. And eventually, the government had to acknowledge that there was absolutely no evidence of that at all.
That's fine. I didn't know that, you know, because that was the same fake charge that they raised against the leaders of the Russian Revolution, that they were taking German money.
Mm-hmm.
The government took the position that, quote, anti-war sentiment equaled aid to a foreign government. The great socialist and unionist Eugene V. Debs was sent to prison for 10 years for an anti-war speech in Canton, Ohio, on the eve of the war. What did Debs say?
Well, Debs' speech was actually during the war. He spoke at a park in Canton, Ohio on June 16, 1918, to a large gathering of people. And Debs was very much aware that there would have been spies, you know, undercover law enforcement actors in his audience. And he spoke about how he had to be careful about the words he chose and even the subjects he sought to address. In the main, he gave a speech supporting socialism and advocating the common interests of working people the world over. But just 2 weeks later, the federal government obtained an indictment against him in federal court in Cleveland, Ohio, which covered, you know, in the Northern District of Ohio, covering Canton, alleging that he violated the Espionage Act with some of his anti-war statements.
Dean, how did the IWW prosecutions help transform the U.S. Justice Department into a powerful tool of political repression?
Well, think about before 1917. Think about how governments and capital dealt with labor disturbances or the threat of labor actions that might cripple commerce. Okay, what they had always done since the origins of the labor movement, whenever in the 1850s or 1860s you might want to trace those back to, what employers and governments always had done is treat that as a local problem, and to be dealt with in really a quasi-military fashion, Heidi. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have a strike on or one threatened in a particular town or city. Well, the employers might go to the mayor if he's sympathetic to capital, as they usually were, or go to the sheriff if the sheriff was sympathetic, or the governor. These local officials, ordinarily then as now, are allies of moneyed interests. So the employers would go to the sheriff, let's say, and, you know, say they're gonna strike, and that's gonna hurt my economic interests. I've hired strike breakers, and I've hired Pinkerton agency operatives to come in and try to break up the strike, and I've hired replacement workers and toughs, you know, to try to deter or break up the strike. Why don't you deputize those people? Make them sheriff's deputies for the time. That'll give them the powers of arrest and, you know, the right to use deadly force when a private citizen couldn't. And compliant mayors and deputies and police chiefs would do that. compliant governors might call out the state militia if it was a particularly large job action, let's say. But these were ad hoc, very local, reactive responses, again, sort of with a quasi-military quality, for want of a better word. And what you see change here during World War I with the effort to destroy the IWW was industrial interests recognizing that this is a national problem, or they portrayed it as a national threat, and that the IWW was big enough and far enough flung to defy local efforts. And so industrialists and politicians responsive to them began to look to Washington, D.C., the War Department and the Labor Department initially with the same model in mind that, you know, you quell this sort of a threat with bodies in the street, you know, with bayonets and troops. But in fact, the Wilson administration routed it to the Justice Department, and a legalist approach emerges here for the first time, where you're relying on lawyers and the forms of law to try to address this just domestic threat, perceived threat, and to do so proactively. And that's what I think is really remarkable about the Chicago trial and then the three other related indictments.
Dean, speaking of forms of law, at the IWW trial, the judge said, quote, "When the country is at peace, it is a legal right of free speech to oppose going to war and to oppose even preparation for war. But when once war is declared, this right ceases." Is this still true today?
Well, you're quoting Judge Landis accurately at the sentencing, and he, you know, that's jarring. I hope that's jarring to our ears today.
Yes.
But he really accurately encapsulated the way federal courts understood the First Amendment freedom of speech in that day. That really was, a homespun but largely accurate description of where First Amendment jurisprudence stood, and stood for years after World War I. You know, whatever our concerns, and we should have them, about repression of dissent, you know, or sort of government efforts to control the dissemination of embarrassing information or information that may, you know, cast the United States government in a bad light. I mean, ask Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning about that. Daniel Ellsberg, you know, a generation ago. Whatever our rightful concerns about that, I think we do have to say fairly that we have a greater realm for free expression today. You and I can stand up publicly on a stump if we want and oppose a war while it's ongoing. The people who protested the Vietnam War, I think fairly understood, were not prosecuted simply for the expression of an opinion. And the government made an effort, at least, to try to limit the prosecution to acts of violence or efforts to respond with more than opinion or ideas to an unpopular war. So, you know, we've advanced somewhat in our freedom of expression, there's no doubt. But the government impulse to quell dissent, to conceal crimes and misdeeds that inevitably occur during war, remains just as strong as it did 100 years ago. I mean, we have a long pattern in this country of foregoing prosecution of those who commit the war crimes, but prosecuting instead those who reveal or disclose them.
Yeah, amen to that. Dean, as we speak, the truth-telling journalist Julian Assange has been indicted by Trump's Justice Department. He's being accused because of his publishing leaks about American war crimes. What does the case against the IWW teach us about the Julian Assange indictment?
Well, we've got to be very wary of government claims of secrecy and not to be challenged in doing that with information in its own files. You know, look, the initial Julian Assange indictment in spring of 2018 was one count, and it alleged essentially hacking, you know, a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. There's questions about whether we ought to be prosecuting that, but if you've accessed without authority a server, a computer, that's potentially a crime, and I understand that. The superseding indictment, just handed down last month in May of 2019, adds 17 counts under the Espionage Act of 1917, the very statute in its modern form now that was used to prosecute the Wobblies 100 years ago. And what you have there sort of nakedly is the government attempting to imprison somebody who has disclosed information in government files that casts the government in an unflattering light. Now, I don't know in the end, and I'm going to be judicious about this and not try to, you know, prejudge anything, and I certainly don't have adequate knowledge to speak confidently or reliably about what the government's case is. But I think, you know, we all ought to have real questions about whether Assange had the specific intent in disclosing the information he did from Guantanamo and from the Afghan War and the Afghanistan War and the Iraq War. Did he have the specific intent to aid a hostile foreign power in doing that? Or was his intent to inform a public that might otherwise blindly accept government falsehoods and government assurances that we're in the right at every step of those wars? You know, there's reason to be concerned that his motives were to bring sunshine to government wrongdoing, not to assist any specific foreign power or to do harm to the legitimate interests of the people of the United States.
One last question for you. You wrote this wonderful book, Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department and the Fall of the IWW. And you observe in the book that, quote, in the end, we do not study history to learn about the past for the sake of the past. We should study history to see more sharply the present, to understand how the past carried us to the present. With this improved clarity, we can then imagine the future we want. In a nutshell, Dean Strang, what kind of future do we want?
I want a future where the public has the information available to it to hold to account rogue government officials. I want a future in which privacy of thought, action, is a value that we continue to hold. I want a future in which we are not constantly under surveillance, whether by Facebook or Google or the FBI, or the NSA or the CIA. I want a future, in other words, in which we recognize our own humanity and push back constantly against those who would dehumanize us or revel in inhumanity.
Dean, where can listeners get a hold of your wonderful book?
Ideally from the University of Wisconsin Press, because every university press in the country and probably in the world is under financial strain. And we're a smarter, stronger country because of these folks who run university presses. But you can also get the book at any online bookseller you want.
Or old-fashioned bookstores, brick and mortar.
Or old-fashioned bookstores. And we need to visit them, too.
Right.
We need to visit all of those bookstores. These people are doing what they can to keep us intelligent.
Dean Strang, you wrote this terrific book, Keep the Wretches in Order. We hope people will go out and get a copy and read it. And Heidi and I thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
After 40 years in prison, Janine and Janet Africa were recently released from SCI Cambridge Springs in Pennsylvania after a long fight for parole. Members of the so-called Move 9, 63-year-old Janine and 68-year-old Janet, were arrested and imprisoned for a crime they say they did not commit after a police siege of their home in August 1978. The two were the last of four women to be paroled or to die behind bars. Listeners may recall that MOVE members lived in Philadelphia in a communal house with founder John Africa. The MOVE group championed equal treatment for African Americans and an abiding respect for nature and animals. Their attitudes brought them into conflict with neighbors and the police. After a siege lasting several months, on August 8, 1978, officers went in to clear the group from the property. In the melee, Officer James Ramp was shot and killed. Despite the fact that MOVE claimed they were unarmed and that Officer Ramp was killed by friendly fire, five men and four women were each sentenced to 30 years to life in prison. Joining us to talk about this recent but long overdue victory is attorney Brad Thompson with the People's Law Office in Chicago. Brad was one of the attorneys securing the women's release. Brad, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Brad, to help our listeners, let's go back briefly to the year 1976. That marked the beginning of several tragedies for MOVE family members. It was 2 years before the 1978 siege, and police harassed MOVE members at their house in Powelton Village. What happened there?
Right. In 1976 through 1978, there were a number of sort of altercations where the police attacked MOVE, and in one of those, tragically, a child, a newborn child named Life Africa, who is the child of, was the child of Janine Africa, who was just recently released, was knocked to the ground and killed by police during this attack on MOVE family members. And that was following a sort of rally outside of the MOVE house when a number of MOVE members had been released from jail. And between that point and 1978, there were a number of standoffs, and one very, in 1977, a very prominent standoff where there were members of MOVE that were demonstrating with inoperable weapons to show a sort of a sort of performance of defending their families and their home. And there was a series of negotiations with the city of Philadelphia and the MOVE family, which the city repeatedly violated the terms of the agreements and failed to act in good faith. And members of MOVE had been arrested at demonstrations and had been in and out of courts for a number of months prior to August of 1978. And in August of 1978 is when the city of Philadelphia was requesting that MOVE remove themselves from their property or they were going to force an eviction. And like I said, there was an agreement that MOVE would leave that property, but part of that was that the city would help find an appropriate location for them to live otherwise, and also that whole sort of situation with them being there being warrants for their arrest on August 8th was based upon an expectation that may not be required to appear in court. So that's a little bit of background of some back and forth between the city of Philadelphia and the MOVE family and that led up to August 8th, 1978.
Now, why were Janine and Janet convicted and imprisoned?
So in total, there were 9 individuals who are known as the MOVE 9 who were in the house on August 8, 1978. And there were other adults and other children also in the house at the time. But there was an attack and a siege on the MOVE house on August 8th in which thousands of rounds of bullets were shot into the home, where thousands of gallons of water and tear gas were pumped into the house to try to force the MOVE family out. And during this melee, a number of police officers were shot, and one of them was shot and killed, an officer named James Ramp. And MOVE members have always maintained that they were innocent of that, and that the forensic evidence suggests that the trajectory of the shot was not coming from the basement of the MOVE house, but was actually coming from behind the officer. So either friendly fire or possibly, and there's some witnesses that have testified that there were shots coming from across the street from the MOVE house, unrelated to the MOVE organization. And so then there were a number of other adults who were either released or charged separately, and some were not charged because they were not MOVE members. It was very clear that this was a case made against the MOVE 9 because they were 9 individuals who were part of the MOVE organization and committed to the revolutionary principles of MOVE. So these 9 people were then tried and convicted of a number of charges, including third-degree murder. And there was no evidence presented that the fatal shot came from any of the individual defendants of the MOVE 9. And in fact, the trial court and a subsequent district court found that there was no evidence that any of the women had ever even brandished any weapons or any officers even claimed that they had any weapons. So of those 9 individuals, they were all sentenced to the 30 to 100 years and began being eligible for parole in 2008.
Which is really astonishing. I think that the friendly fire theory serves 2 purposes. One, it exonerates the police if they indeed did shoot a fellow officer. And 2, it gets them conveniently the excuse they need to arrest members of the MOVE family.
Right.
Brad, why do you think that Janine and Janet were denied parole for how many years? What, 8 years or so? What changed?
So, you know, all the surviving members of the MOVE 9, there's 7 of them that are surviving, have been eligible since 2008 and were repeatedly denied parole. And the justifications that they were given were really boilerplate standard explanations that they were got a negative recommendation from the prosecuting attorney, that they failed to demonstrate remorse, or they minimized their role in the offense. And those are particularly impossible rationales to address when the basis of their convictions was just the fact that they were in the house and were members of MOVE. And they've never denied that. They never minimized their role there. And so repeatedly they would go before the parole board and be denied. And you know, there's been a tremendous amount of organizing and campaigning on the outside for their release well before they were eligible for parole, but certainly since they've been going before the parole board, people have been contacting the parole board and putting on pressure. And I think that there's been a cumulative effect there where over time they have been making strides by the parole board recognizing the amount of community support that a lot of these MOVE members have. And in 2018, in May of 2018, Janet and Janine and Debbie Africa were all eligible for parole. And at that point, myself and Brett Grody of the Abolitionist Law Center, we compiled packets on behalf of the three women and submitted those to the parole board, which included their excellent disciplinary histories, all sorts of support letters, not only from loved ones, but also from formerly incarcerated women who were describing how Janet, Janine, and Debbie were remarkable role models, letters from former staff, and we even hired an expert who was the former Secretary of Corrections for the state of Pennsylvania, and he reviewed their prison records and wrote an expert opinion that they were strong candidates for parole, that in his 40 years of experience he had rarely seen such strong examples of people who showed remarkable ability to live in society without risk of recidivism. And we submitted that on behalf of all three women in May of 2018. And Debbie was granted parole, and yet Janet and Janine were denied. And this, again, this is after 9 years of all three women going before the parole board and being denied. And this was the first time that any of the MOVE 9 were granted parole. And so subsequently, Brett and I filed a petition for habeas corpus on behalf of Janet and Janine, alleging that their constitutional rights were being violated because the parole board was violating their substantive due process rights by denying them for arbitrary and capricious reasons that are shocking to the conscience. That's the standard for substantive due process. And so we've been litigating that since last year, since their denial in 2018. And we were prepared, actually, and had a court date for an oral argument on that just days after their release ended up happening.
Good lawyering.
And the women are getting up there in age, so it starts to become really an issue also of compassion, I would imagine.
Absolutely. You know, all the members in the MOVE 9, and like I said, two have died in prison. Phil and Merle Africa both died in prison, and the remaining seven all range now from 59 to 72 or 73. And, you know, like you said, Heidi, you know, this is Janet, Janine, and Debbie are 62, 63, and 67. And so these are women who are mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, and, you know, have spent 40-plus years, or had spent 40-plus years in prison. So it really is a situation where, as are we in the country, are looking more towards mass incarceration and the sort of social impacts of the destructive impact of prisons on communities, and particularly on people that are in aging populations. That's something that we definitely had argued in the in our parole petitions, and that I think is important to recognize, that, you know, these are people that have spent their entire adult lives in prison and still manage to build strong relationships with family members, people on the outside, people on the inside, and that it's only fair and just for them to be released.
I wanted to note that you referenced earlier the tragedy that Janine experienced when her infant child was literally crushed during one of the police raids. But she also had another tragedy after she'd been imprisoned 7 years and the MOVE home was bombed by police. Her other son, Little Phil, was killed along with 9 other MOVE members.
Yes, that's right. And actually, both Janet and Janine each had a child that were in the house that was bombed and allowed to burn by the city of Philadelphia on May 13th, 1985. And, you know, there were a number of MOVE members aside from the Move 9 who were in prison at that time, who had children who were killed, as well as Phil and Delbert Africa. You know, little Phil was Phil's son with Janine, and Delbert and Janet had a daughter who was murdered there on May 13th, 1985 as well. So it really, it shows the way in which there was repeated instances of state violence against these people above and beyond the attack that they endured on August 8th, 1978, and the state violence and their continued incarceration. But there were also repeated examples, both before and after that, when they suffered and lost loved ones because of the violence that the city of Philadelphia projected onto the MOVE organization.
Attorney Brad Thompson, wasn't that the event where the entire neighborhood was burned down? Something like 60 homes were burned down?
Exactly. Once after the decision was made to drop this bomb on the MOVE home, a decision was made to let that fire burn, and exactly, over 60 homes in this middle-class black neighborhood on the west side of Philadelphia were allowed to burn to the ground. And that was a very conscious decision that was made to let that fire burn, because they had been spraying fire hoses, and there were fire trucks on the scene, and they had, before this, had been spraying and using these fire hoses as weapons, spraying them into the home, and then stopped doing that, dropped this bomb. And for, I forget the exact number of, the exact period of time, but for 45 minutes or an hour, I believe, they allowed this fire to continue to burn with these row houses that the fire just spread and decimated this two-block radius.
And there's a very good documentary, literally called Let the Fire Burn, that details this with a lot of the news coverage from the time. It was just an appalling case. Brad, what did this case mean to you?
So, you know, the case of the MOVE 9 to me has always represented the importance of really confronting state power, and that's what the MOVE 9 have always done, both when they were, you know, attacked on August 8th, 1978, and also what they've continued to do is sort of allowing their case to expose the injustices of the criminal legal system. And that's something that, in trying to provide legal support to them and work with the movement in fighting for their release, it's been a sort of important role that really they had the audacity to defy the state and to survive when really they were being attempted to be killed by the city of Philadelphia, both before and after that, as evidenced in 1985. And while I'm still here, we have three more members of the MOVE 9 who were working to get out. That's Chuck Africa, Delbert Africa, and Eddie Africa. Eddie had his parole hearing earlier this year, and we're optimistic that he should be granted parole. And then Delbert is next eligible for parole in September of this year. Chuck is eligible in December. So I'd encourage people to go to the MOVE organization's website to find out more on social media, and also on my office's website, People's Law Office. We have information about the MOVE 9 cases, as well as my co-counsel at Abolitionist Law Center, and encourage people to write to the MOVE 9. They're really remarkable people. Also, Janet and Janine just put up a fundraising link for them, for an online fundraiser for people to donate to help them get their lives back together since their release.
That's excellent advice. They are remarkable people, as are you and Brett, the attorneys. Just a final question. What is the current sentiment, if you know, toward the remaining MOVE members in the Philadelphia area?
In terms, you know, I think that's a good question. You know, I mean, there's certainly the Fraternal Order of Police has been, the vitriol directed towards Mumia has been well documented and off the charts, and MOVE has always been incredibly supportive of Mumia, and Mumia has been incredibly supportive of MOVE. And I believe that a lot of that sort of hostility from the police continues to be directed towards the MOVE organization. I feel like there has been a sort of broader change that over time the MOVE organization has been able to demonstrate that the sort of strength that they have, and I haven't seen quite as much direct hostility directed towards MOVE as I have towards Mumia, for example, and to the same level of prominence. But there certainly still is a level of opposition to MOVE simply because of who they are, what they believe, and because of their history from at least some segments of the Philadelphia police.
Brad, we'll link at lawanddisorder.org the link to the fundraiser for the two women. I wanted to, in our remaining few moments, thank you, Brad Thompson, and thank you for your wonderful law firm, the People's Law Office in Chicago. I know that you've got a 50-year celebration coming up in the fall, and I'll be looking forward to meeting you at the celebration. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Yeah, thank you. Nice talking to you. Looking forward to meeting you there as well, Michael.
Bye-bye,
have a good day.
Brad. Take care.
Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.